Blog Talk Radio.
A slight jazzy intro to Zach Roberts. Hey, Zach.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Happy. Today, this is a Friday, the 20th of March. With a lot going on in the world with the coronavirus happening, how does a photojournalist like yourself, who has covered Occupy Wall Street, who has done the Trump world, Hillary world, Charlottesville, Ferguson, how do you approach something like this? As you are said earlier in the pre-show, that you're like Mad Max going around looking for toilet paper and other essentials. I mean,
yeah, you do it. The joke is you do it very carefully. You do it with a telephoto lens. But this is, this is something that it's actually been a huge problem within the freelance photojournalist world since most, like myself, I'm a freelance photojournalist. And the big problem is what do you cover? What is there to cover? If nothing is going on, if you can't have, like, I am traditionally a protests, rallies, conference kind of photographer, and that sort of thing. So if you can't have a gathering of more than 10 people, none of that stuff is happening. And so, like myself, I'm lucky. I have another job that, well, hopefully it's going to be starting, down in Washington, D.C. But the big problem is that, there's a, my guess is like at least 40% of, the photos that you see in newspapers and online publications, that sort of thing, are done by freelance photojournalists. And
exactly.
Almost none of them have, the thing is like, only what, like 40% or something like that of Americans have $1,000 in savings. Even more, the other half basically have nothing whatsoever and live paycheck to paycheck. Almost every photojournalist I know is in that world. And
exactly.
So there's a lot of people, I'm trying to organize a print sale right now that hopefully, will raise a little bit of funds. There's a lot of mutual aid kind of helping where people can. But we all have rent to pay and we all have bills still to pay since nothing has been stopped. So it's tough out there to say the least.
I find the law of large numbers fascinating because I know that if we could get 2 cents from a million people per month. And I realized with Patreon, I saw that you have there are different buckets. You could have the dollar a month, the $5 a month, the 10, but it's just getting out to a large enough number that would support us as artists.
Yeah. And the important thing, I worked for Greg Palast. He's a BBC, Al Jazeera, investigative researcher, Rolling Stone. One of my many jobs that people I work with, I'm his photographer and one of his head researchers. And thankfully with him, we do a nonprofit. So if you donate to Greg, you get you at least can get a write off. But like we rely on the fact of these tiny, like having 5,000 $5 donors, a month or whatever is the way to do it. But the problem is that so much of, especially the nonprofit world of journalism is reliant on a handful of the Lannan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, things like that. They're reliant on 80% of their income comes from these handful of small. And one thing, when Bernie Madoff basically just walked off with, half of the left's the kind of the liberal world donors money, the journalism world collapsed in one of the most important time periods in history that it could exist in 2009. I was the Palace, like I was working for the Palace Investigative Fund then full time, and I had to be laid off. Like I was still working, you know, freelance and that sort of thing. But like I went from, you know, full time to very, very part time. And because one of our biggest donors was screwed over by Bernie Madoff. But mm-hmm. not much has changed now. All like, you know, there's big grants that like if a lot of these places and that's not just for journalism, but also like a lot of the big activist groups and things like that. If one or two of these donors go away, they're up Schitt's Creek, to say.
Yep.
You know, when it yep. comes to that. And that to me is why things like Patreon and you know, there's about 1,000 different kind of things. Facebook has their own thing now,
sure.
too, and all these places. That's why, like, I think it's really important that, like, I have a Patreon, and I'm not saying that to promote it. I'm saying it because I have a Patreon, and I also basically a lot of that money that I get in Patreon ends up going to mm-hmm. people because I donate to about, I think, 10 different Patreons now, just like a buck or two, you know, whatever, because
sure.
it adds up. And if you get, like I said, if I had 5,000 people that gave me $1 a month, I would be
yep.
able to do full-time journalism. Wouldn't have any doubt, like publish, you know, every couple of days. I wouldn't have to be scrounging for pitching magazine, mm-hmm. you know, pitching news publications and, you know, spending 20% of my time every week trying to go after people for bills and stuff like that. So like,
exactly.
to me, like I always say that one of the best things you can do during the Trump administration, it's not just during this one of these
no.
many crises we've had, is to support your local journalists.
Exactly.
And I'm not talking about necessarily even your local news publication, which definitely support that, especially if they're a good local news publication. But like,
mm-hmm.
there are independent freelance journalists all around you, and a lot of them have like PayPal links, or just, you know, if you find one that you really like, and be like, hey, how can we support your work? You know. Like, just find out what's your PayPal link and send them $5. Then you can buy coffee,
wonderful.
And buy 2 gallons of gas, and do some of this work and take off the burden of so much of the, well, we got to wait, you know, because I know a bunch of friends that are getting laid off in the next couple months.
Yeah.
Or
exactly.
next month, actually, like a great news publication out in California is laying off half their staff. You know, the venture capital funds that have been investing in large newspaper chains are now
uh-huh.
basically tightening their britches and laying off entire staffs, especially photojournalists. They're always the first ones to go.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that really, really badly in Chicago. Luckily that's kind of changed since they realized, oh my God, wait, people buy newspapers for the photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people don't actually read past the headline, and then, but it's the photos. So
isn't it amazing?
Circulation drops, but yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think about that. I think about the difference between the moving image and the still image. I don't know if you remember, but back during Vietnam, I'm 71, so that was during the Vietnam, they showed an execution by a South Vietnamese general who was executing
yep.
a suspected North Vietnamese. And
yep.
that, and I've watched it on film, and I've also watched it in still.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the little
yeah.
girl that was burned, the little girl
yeah.
that was burned by napalm, and she's running naked. And I have seen,
yeah.
and I've watched it. I watched the film and the still image, and the still image of both of those changed the fucking world.
Yeah. And we still have the scenario. I shoot both still and video. I kind of alternate back and forth depending on what I'm doing. Luckily, I have a one of these new mirrorless cameras now that I can actually do both simultaneously.
No
so I can
kidding.
Taking video and then taking oh. frames of basically screen captures, essentially, of like usually I shoot in 4K, like so super
yeah.
high quality. So it's almost the same Ooh. Quality as if I was just shooting stills. It's changed the way I work. It's changed the way I work. Just buying this one, like moving, upgrading to this camera, Nikon, the Nikon Z6, if anyone.
Good, yes,
I'm a Nikon professional service member, so I always got a
skill
for them.
Yeah. So would you sell advertising on your back? Like, would you wear a vest powered by Nikon?
If they,
you know,
if they
like a stock
me,
car
a
racer,
people,
like a.
My, Both of my camera straps are have Nikon branding on them because they gave them to me. So
right.
The answer is already yes.
Yeah. But I was
I'm
thinking about different ways. How can we think about this?
Yeah. No. I mean, if it was like, you know, if like ExxonMobil said, "Hey, we'll fund your," no, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Or maybe I would use that money to investigate ExxonMobil. Yeah.
Let me give you just a. This is fascinating. I last year I went to an energy conference here in Austin that the president of ExxonMobil. Upstream is everything before they get to their refinery, right?
Yeah.
That's so he's the president of Exxon Upstream. And he said, we, Exxon, are preparing for a zero carbon future.
Yeah.
Said it to the whole thing. And I'm going, really?
Yeah.
And that's amazing because if they're running those scenarios and they're preparing for it, what's your sense? You know, I had a conversation with Peter Tork many, many years ago. This is the Monkees. It was a big group way back then at that time. And he finished 10 years later, afterward, I got a chance in 1979 to do an interview with him. And we had this conversation about capitalism. How do you feel about how capitalism can either support us? Because I'm a capitalist. I believe in fetters. I believe we need fetters on our capitalism, you know, like really ways to level the playing field, ways to do. But I believe in the basic concept of it and the basic concept of the human being as a communitarian tribal species, and we're going to get through this even though we get wrapped up in materialism. So now that I've said something, why don't you say something and help me?
I mean, I have I think that I'm a bit more on the left when it comes to economic issues and socialism and things like that. But I mean, I think that if nothing else, that the scenarios that we're in right now, everything that we look in, the fact that there are shortages of things, even with people hoarding and doing the things they're doing, but even with limiting, even now, I went into a Walgreens, the only place, or no, I was where is it? I was actually in a grocery store called Wegmans. It's a big chain here, limiting two rolls of toilet paper per person, and they still were almost completely out because everyone's doing what. What has amazed me is that everyone, Milton Friedman, that kind of world of capitalism.
Yep.
I wouldn't assume that you're in that level.
Oh God, no. I'm much more to the left.
Exactly. That's the calling more of Elizabeth Warren than the. But to me, if nothing else, this is proven that the invisible hand of the free market is giving us all the middle finger right now, and the fact that. All that, yeah, I know that. Good,
that's
I finally
great.
Got a laugh from that joke.
That's
good.
Great.
I keep trying it, and no one is
I
like,
love it.
You know.
I
but,
love it.
But, but the fact that we have not, that government has to tell companies to make face masks, that government has to tell companies directly and through some level of actual order, built whatever process to make ventilators, things that we need and that will people will buy, proves to me that the free market free market capitalism is a complete and utter fraud and a failure, because we need toilet paper, we need these things, we need whatever, and you have small businesses like distilleries are now making hand sanitizers. All of these companies, all they have to do is build up. In before World War II, we went from making cars, and then the next week we made tanks.
Yep.
We went from making whatever to making munitions and whatever, and these things changed overnight. Thanks to the strict idea that, you know, corporations should only be good for their bottom dollar, none of these companies and their immediate careful bottom dollar, none of these companies are willing to take the risk of hiring on a bunch of more people because, you know, they still think that keep being told by the government, by President Trump, that, oh, this is not a big deal. We're going to, you know, this isn't as big deal as you're going to say, and we're not providing any real aid, and we can't really decide whether we're going to give people money so that they can buy things. And so you have a complete failure of the businessman as president, first off, and you have a complete failure of free market capitalism. You know, I don't I don't know if socialism would do pure socialism, whatever that means, would do do necessarily 100% better. But if nothing else, if someone could say, no, there are things that we need and you need to make them now, that would be useful so that people.
He's been given here. Here's the thing about it is that I I'm hoping, and I don't know how long this will last or whatever, but that enough of the country will wake up to the understanding that competence matters. And that we have that Defense Authorization Act that he can, he signed it, but he's afraid to use it because he, because this is Dennis's opinion, whether it's true or not, I don't know. But Dennis's opinion is that he's afraid to use it because he doesn't feel competent to or have the confidence in the people underneath him to make a wise decision that's judicious of where and how to allocate the allocate the resources. And so instead he can stand back and just go, well, you know, basically you're on your own.
Well, let the states do it. So you have 50 competing or actually 51 because Washington DC competing entities over to try to get face masks, to try to get ventilators and try to get all these things that we're already currently needing and going to need more. I mean, Governor Cuomo here in New York is one of the few people that seems to be actually competent, yet still he's making hand sanitizer and he's using slave prison slave labor to do it.
Exactly.
The New York hand sanitizer is made in prisons. And so is anything else that he's going to do, you know, and they're getting paid nickels an hour at best. And so like we need the fact that he still hasn't called up FEMA, the fact that like state and local governments are or state governments are having to call up the military, which it's fine in a time to me, it's fine in a time of, you know, when we have a hurricane and things like that, and we do need, you know, like order needs to be protected and we need like, I don't know, trees moved and like physical things done. But if it's literally making sure that, you know, I don't know what, like medicines are handed out, I don't want the National Guard doesn't know how to do this. Like, I mean, sure, I'm sure some of them do, but they don't know how to do this. FEMA has people that can do that. But if you have to call them up and do it, I mean, to me, that's been one of the biggest things that's been driving me nuts is that like, this is, you know, somebody said that this is actually after a dozen different Trump's Katrinas, this may be Trump's Katrina. And I mean, I still think that, you know, I mean, we still haven't reached the number of people that died in Katrina because of Bush's incompetency and the local and state governments planned incompetency, actually. But that's well, I did a film back in 2006 with Greg Palast called Big Easy to Big Empty that I think it should be free on YouTube. So definitely watch that if you
wonderful.
Want to see what's to come.
Wonderful, so. Because I'm you know Houston here and what happened. Well, let me ask a question about that then. Okay, let's take a look. If we looked, because of all your photojournalism and where you're going around to Ferguson and to the Occupy Wall Street and the different places that you have been, Charlottesville. Looking at Trump as the symptom and not the disease, absolutely, we need to treat the symptom. No question, we need to get rid of him. I want that. But what he has tapped into and what he has uncovered or brought into the bold daylight for us to get a chance to look at as a country is the thing that I'm interested in discussing.
I've been covering the far right. Unknowingly, because I cover voter suppression. So people like Chris Kobach in Kansas, I've been covering him since 2006. I've been going to CPAC every year since I think was it 2010 or 11. I, you know, just through happen to covering the, you know, you cover this thing, you know, cover these things at Ferguson. I interviewed an oath keeper that was holding a sniper's position on top of a dentist's office, above all things, pointing his guns at the protesters down the street. He actually told me that he would shoot anyone that was trying to attack me if I put up my hands and ran down the middle of the street. So from then on, I did not ever put up my hands and never ran anywhere because I was terrified that a bullet would whiz by my head. Yeah, no, that interview, I did that for the mudflats.net. You can probably still find it on there. It's a pretty weird interview because I interviewed him in a dentist's office. But I didn't know that I was covering the slow buildup to a Donald Trump. And because all of these figures, Kris Kobach, the Oath Keepers, you know, members of the far right, the CPAC and everything like that, I never thought CPAC would become the cult of Donald Trump. That was a surprise to me. I never thought that the NRA, something I've been covering for years as well, would become a cult of Donald Trump. I didn't think that up until I was at an NRA convention and Donald Trump, who hadn't announced yet, was the biggest cheering and clapping anyone that was there. And he's the only one on stage that's like, yeah, I don't really like guns, but my sons do. And Eric and Donald came out, Don Jr. came out and taught, you know, those guys are big game hunters because they like to, they can only shoot slow moving, large animals. That's a whole different story. But the fact that this buildup, this has been going on the entire, I mean, it's been definitely going on before the Obama administration, militia, you know, talking about militias and talking about, you know, since even before, you know, McVeigh
French
and Oklahoma
Davidian.
City. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so you had this entire thing, entire buildup. And what Trump did was basically the combo of having a black president, which just coincidentally, the Oath Keepers just happened to decide that the Constitution was under threat the moment that Barack Obama was elected. Not over, and I asked them this question, and we're like, you didn't have a problem with George W. Bush, who continually ripped up the Constitution via the Patriot Act, which they hate.
Yeah.
They hate the Patriot Act. They'll blame the Patriot Act on the Democrats because the Democrats have reauthorized it and actually expanded it oftentimes. So, you know, they're not the only people, Republicans are not the only people at fault in a lot of these things, but the fact that you have to
I want to get beyond one other thing.
Yeah.
I want to get beyond fault. I want to get to what the, you know, it's one of the things in the 12 step movement that I so ascribe to is that it's not your fault, but it is your problem.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. This is this. What the fuck?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, I was definitely shocked. I mean, I had been following a lot of the far right, watching the MAGA crowd drift even farther right. You know, I mean, they were already kind of there, but, you know, I interviewed probably about 100 Donald Trump supporters on the floor of all the things and talking to them and be like, and so the entire time you have the media talking about how, oh, well, they, I always forget how the phrase goes, but it's like they don't believe him, or they listen to him, but they don't believe him, and or something like that. I'm like, no,
they take him.
They take him literally.
They don't take him literally.
Yeah, they take. Yeah, exactly. They took him literally. They took him figuratively. They took him everything left and right, up and down, and they were fully embraced on him early on. And I was back in in New Hampshire when the primary. Up in New Hampshire back in 2016, 2016. I was just like, oh no, if he actually sticks in, because I didn't necessarily believe that he was going to stick around. I thought he was going to kind of play around in there again, like he did. He did at previous elections. If he sticks around, he's going to win the nomination. And then it was like Clinton came along, basically gave the middle finger to Bernie Sanders supporters. Bernie Sanders supporters didn't feel any sort of thing. And I'm like, oh no, he's going to win, because I would go to Hillary Clinton rallies. There'd be 300 people there, and most of them from out of state. I'd go to a Donald Trump rally. There's 14,000 people, every single one of them just from that little location. Like, I remember a couple of weeks before the election being in a airplane hangar in a part of North Carolina that was just hit by a hurricane just the week before. My hotel was shut down. The only thing open was a Waffle House and a Donald Trump rally, and there was 5,000 people in that place. It was packed. And I go, they're not taking this seriously. Hillary's not taking this seriously. The media is not taking this seriously because they still think, you know, I mean, there's that famous news clip of Keith Ellison being laughed out of, basically laughed at by a bunch of supposed political experts like Maggie Halberman from the Times, where he's like, he could win this. And they're all, you know, it's like, I because people don't have a deep enough understanding about how close we are to something very bad happening. And that was, you know, that ended up being Charlottesville, ended up being about a dozen other things. I mean, that's one thing. I'm starting a podcast called Isolated Incidents, which is talking about all of these different quote unquote isolated incidents that happen with white extremism. And almost every single one of them, huge Donald Trump supporters. They have MAGA stickers and everything like that. Once you look at the court photos, and they're huge fans of his. And so these people have been out there and they didn't have a leader. So they're kind of like just kind of wandering, being, you know, it's like if you live in a small town, almost everybody has that one, that guy with the racist, he's got the InfoWars stickers on and he's a loon. Now they have a leader and he's in the White House and he's doing everything that they always dream to do, which is, you know, calling the press fake news and screaming at them that they're liars and, you know, telling everyone that this is a Chinese virus and saying that Mexicans are rapists and everything that these guys wanted, and they've been emboldened. And then there's a whole bunch of other people that were kind of in the middle ground. We're like, you know, like, oh, I don't know if I like Donald Trump. The only problem they have with him, it's always surprises me. The only problem they have with him is like, oh, I just wish he didn't tweet so much. Like, his tweets are always a bad thing. And I go, really? But the, you know, putting children in camps is not a bad thing. You know, like, this is, I mean, it's scary because you have this huge swath in the middle, you know, that not necessarily, I'm not even talking about Democrat or whatever. I've been talking about like just a conservative to left perspective, this huge swath in the middle that would be perfectly fine with Donald Trump if he would stop tweeting. Literally, that's it. Like, I bet if he said, I'm leaving Twitter tomorrow, his popularity would probably, give it 2 months, he'd win the election, without a doubt. But thankfully,
that hurts me. That really hurts for that to possibly be true.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, I don't. You know, thankfully, you know, I mean, like, you can blame, you know, like a lot of, you know, the Hillary Clinton fans love to blame the Bernie Sanders fans. The crossover was not that much compared to how many people in 2008 crossed over as Hillary Clinton voters over to John McCain voters after she left the primary. It's like triple. It's like 14% versus like 6% or something. But
I not only do I understand your perspective but I also feel, having been, you know, we were talking earlier before the podcast, being raised by women, being and as I was the same with my mother as a single mother, there is a misogyny in this country that we have not dealt with. That runs deep within, that we will not give the same credit to, or the same length of leash, or the same willingness to believe to a woman that we will to a man.
And it's misogyny, and it's also, and this, I hate to be the straight white guy that's going immediately, let's put this on the blame of women. but it's also, it's terrifying to me how many women have this. How many Donald
True.
Trump, because I would talk to Donald Trump supporters.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would talk to Donald Trump supporters that are women, and I just, you know, it's kind of like, oh, you're kind of brought here by your husband. I'm like, no. A lot of times the other way around.
Thank you.
Like, the husband doesn't really care. He's not really political, but she's all about it. And they're some of the most, you know, because they have to be so much more extreme. I mean, like, you look at like a lot of the far right figures like Michelle Malkin and things like that, that that are female that have to be so much more. It's like I've always found it when I'm covering protests and stuff like that, a lot of times the women are the first cops to pull out their baton and start hitting people because they have to prove themselves to the guys. And also because, you know, it's something that it's like, and I asked this to a bunch of other journalists. They're like, yeah, no, I see that all the time, especially like NYPD has always been bad that way. But that's when I think one thing that shocked the heck out of everyone in America, wow, when white women were really the people that pulled, yep, America to Donald Trump in 2016. And I don't know if they're going to change now. You know, I mean, Joe Biden isn't really a great figure to bring people together. Like, supposedly that's the advertisement, that's the whole purpose he exists. And if he doesn't, I don't know who he can pick as a VP. I don't know what can happen to change people, but I mean, the polls haven't changed that much when it comes to white women and do it.
No.
I mean, I'm happy at least my mom, who is probably the weirdest voter in America, she voted for Nader in 2000 because she asked me who to vote for. And then 2004, she voted for Bush. And then 2008, I don't know who she voted for. So I know in 2016 she did not, but she voted for Hillary Clinton. So at least I got that, even though her husband, good, my stepfather, voted for Trump and is still a Trump fan. But it is it's been kind of terrifying to, you know, people. One thing that Trump I don't even like to say it's a good thing, but thanks to Trump, you know where everyone stands now. You know,
yeah,
you know, like, you know where people are and how they feel about it. I mean, I'm parked outside because I've been running errands. I'm parked outside a pharmacy, but I can see from across the street my local liquor store. And I was in there a couple months ago after covering a Trump rally in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, that was really, really – it turned into, like, a lot of violence outside and that sort of thing. The cops,
mm-hmm,
did tear gas, whatever. It was bad. Pepper spray all over the place. But he was one of the cashiers was wearing a Trump hat, and I just made some kind of, usually don't say anything, I don't whatever, but like, it was a local store that I go into continually.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, you're a Trump fan? And yeah. I'm a journalist, and he's not really nice to us. And he's like, well, what do you write about him? And it's like, that's what the reply is. What did you do?
Exactly.
What did you do to make people hate you? And I'm just like, I'm a photojournalist. I don't do anything. Like,
yep.
I don't do anything actively, you know, when it comes to my journalism, but it's scary that it's like, it's everywhere now. I mean, I live in kind of a rural area, part of upstate New York. And, you know, people always think New York State is this liberal bastion. I live in red country. I live in deep Trump country. There are Trump flags,
yeah,
just a mile down the road from here. I had somebody after Charlottesville on my street use their kids' chalk paint to draw the Confederate flag on the street.
Mm-hmm.
That was Martin Luther King Day weekend, right after Charlottesville. And
sure.
So it is really making you really know where everyone stands. And that's good and bad, but it's also, I don't know how we recover from this. Even if Biden wins and it was just a one-term thing, Biden's not the – I don't think he's the type of guy that can bring it. He thinks that he's just going to be able to, in January, work with these Republicans.
He's crazy. How did
Obama?
That work? Yeah. Exactly. So let's not.
Yeah.
That's a every time he says something like, yeah, that, it's ridiculous, because it goes against every single thing that all of us can know. The thing that heartens me, yeah, in one sense was how, with no money, no field offices, no nothing, the citizenry stood up and said, hold on a second, we're going to moderate this election. This was a grassroots movement that moved for, and you know, as much as he annoys me, and of course being his age and this, he would naturally annoy me. But as much as the things that annoy me and that I'm uncomfortable with Joe Biden, the people standing up And this was not a big movement of establishment Democrats. It felt to me like the people stood up, and that they, the people who were actually voting, took hold of this and said, hold on a second, we need something here. Even though it's not all the way there, it at least gets something there.
Unfortunately, I'm much more of a deep pessimist, and or I don't know about things. But the way that I read that was that the corporate media,
please,
mainstream media, the politicians, local leaders, especially within the
African American community,
like leadership community, outside of like Jesse Jackson, who's a friend of mine, they're conservative. I mean, like, you go to black, I spend a lot of time in black churches, thanks to voting rights and things like that. They're conservative. You know, I mean, they're liberal, like, as in they're like, you know, I mean, they're more like, you know, it's like in the world of like Nancy Pelosi Democrats or something like that. They're liberal.
Right.
But they're deeply worried about change and dramatic change. And the problem with someone like Biden is that, never mind the fact that he has a really long record and not a really good
one. Totally.
And that will be used. I mean, this is one of my biggest fears when it comes to the national election, because there's a deep difference between primary voters and national election voters. And that's
totally,
even within African-American and Hispanic communities and things like that.
Yep.
There are people that turn up for the primaries, and those states are states like Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, states that don't normally go for Democrats and don't go for somebody, even somebody like Joe Biden. South Carolina is, to me, it was like, that was the turning point for Joe Biden's campaign, except it's the first state he's going to lose in November. There's no world where he wins November. You know, I mean, unless this whole thing goes into apocalyptic levels, and then that's a whole different story. Whether or not we'll, you know, I wouldn't even joke about whether or not we'll have an election or not.
No, but, we don't know. But this entire, I mean, the way I make my living until I can somehow transition into doing the communications and representing my cohort and having conversations with you more is to talk with people and do communication coaching within industry, within the petrochemical. Right now I'm doing it within major insurance and companies in this, and they all see that the ways that we're going to work are not going to be the same. And this particular crisis is all it did was accelerate.
Yeah.
It did not change. We are not going back to a normal.
And in a part way, I hope that we don't. The fact that we've had, you know, sorry to jump at the petrochemical, but, you know, we had the BP oil spill in the Gulf. We had go back 30 years, and we had the spill in Exxon Valdez spill, which also BP has a lot to blame with that. That's another story. But, you know, you have that. You've had, you know, massive, you know, you've had massive environmental change over the last thing, and nothing has changed. No innovation has happened within the oil industry on how to do cleanups, how to prevent these things. Nothing. They're still using paper towels to clean up oil spills. I mean, like, that was the savings. That I have, like, photos. I have friends of mine photos from the Diesel Beach Night Island, in which I've been to. You can still smell the gasoline there. Was there like 3-5 years ago, and you can still smell the gasoline, and made me nauseous just being there for 20 minutes. And you can still. What's that?
Bless your heart.
Yeah. It was a long ride. I mean, it's sad. I mean, I went out there with a friend of mine and colleague, Shannon Moore, who's an Alaskan radio show host, she was a fisherwoman, a captain of a boat, and she converted her boat like in a weekend to do oil cleanup. And then she almost died during the cleanup because she was in a Zodiac boat that the corrects it, that the oil companies were dropping from the air onto the oil to, quote unquote, dissolve the oil.
Right.
Actually, what it does is dissolves anything that has like fats in it, or anything that has like, you know, like, so it will dissolve glue, it'll dissolve your stomach, it'll dissolve anything. And it dissolved away the basically attachment of the motor to the Zodiac, and it broke her arm, and then it went under, and she almost drowned and died of almost froze to death in the waters in I think it would have been March then, so, you know, place. And so, well, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, you have governments that are every single time moderate, right-wing,
yeah.
moderate, right-wing,
yep.
and you don't have change. You know, Barack Obama still didn't do anything. You know, he has been fantastic for oil companies. They just moved everything onshore, you know, when it comes to fracking and it comes to
mm-hmm.
When it comes to even offshore drilling, you know, he moved a lot of that to be okayed, you know, with a asterisk, you know, you have to try to be a little bit cleaner. And so I think that we need to be dragged kicking and screaming into making some level of change. And
when in the history of humanity has that not been true?
Yeah. I mean, it's not wrong. I mean, but one of the
I'm serious about this, because we only have 3 more minutes, and unless you would, it's not just unless, but I will track you down to do another podcast, because I want to talk deeper about this, because how we get change and how we institute and manifest change and have it work with something that is as complex and nuanced and huge beyond my ability to wrap my mind around it, which is this particular economy, and not even counting how it's connected to everything else, how we
yeah.
do that and institute it in a way that can do, well, I don't know. I'm hoping that there'll be lessons from what we're going through right now and at the end of March 2020 that will help us make some lessons here.
I mean, I hope so too. I don't, you know, I don't necessarily like, I think if it's the problem, one of the problems is I have this thing. I keep toying around with writing a book that's titled "It Never Got Bad Enough." None of these crises ever get bad enough in our country. I mean, like Iraq,
right.
it definitely got bad enough and it got worse, and then it keeps getting worse. But for us, it never gets bad enough, because at the moment a hero comes in, or TARP comes in and bails out the big banks so that the
mm-hmm.
entire capitalism facade doesn't collapse.
Yep.
Or at the last second in 3 weeks, Trump is finally, or somebody in Congress is finally going to do something, or even worse, when you had like the financial
yeah.
crisis for actual people, not for corporations in 2009, it didn't get bad enough that the upper middle class were hurting, that the solid middle
right.
class were really affected. So you just keep
yeah.
have this slow drift where the bottom, it used to be a bottom third of the country. Now it's a bottom 50%, and it gets to be a bottom
mm-hmm.
60% of the country, that people that don't have enough money to survive for a month or
yep.
even a week, you know, I mean, so it never gets
well,
bad enough. And that's honestly one of the problems with our form of democracy, is that we are never pushed far enough that will make that dramatic change. There is no World War II, no Marshall Plan, oddly, ironically,
yep.
for us, which is what we need.
And
we need, you know,
which is
we
exactly,
need a new deal.
God, I love that. And I love the idea of a new Marshall Plan. All right, let's
an American
put a pin
one.
In it there. Let's put a pin in it there, and we'll look for George. See if we can resurrect. We'll go out there and resurrect. Resurrect the general and get him back out there, and see what we can do. But thank you so much for Zach, for giving me this time, and thank you for getting out on the front lines and talking to people and having the kinds of conversations that you're willing to have, because I know that through this way, one human being to another, we can make that difference. And we won't know when it is. We won't know when that tipping point, but it will be there.
Yep.
Well, thanks for coming
so
on the program.
This was a great conversation. Anytime.
All right. We'll do it again. Count on it. Goodbye, everybody.